right? Good? All right. Hi, everyone. I'm Lindsay Treadway. I'm from Exelixis. Thank you all for joining for the Exelixis and Ipsen Financial Community and Media Briefing webcast. We're very pleased to be here today with our partner Ipsen, providing this update live from the 2016 European Society for Medical Oncology Congress at Copenhagen to discuss the results of the CABOSUN Phase 2 trial in advanced renal cell carcinoma, as well as other key data presented at the Congress. Joining us for the discussion today is Dr. Tony Schwery, the director of the Link Center for Genitourinary Oncology at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute and the principal investigator of both the METEOR and CABOSUN trials. We're also delighted to have with us Dr. Monty Paul, co-director of City Hope's Kidney Cancer Program and head of the Kidney and Bladder Cancer Disease Team at the institution. Dr. Nazir Tanir, professor and deputy chair of genitourinary medical oncology at the University of Texas MD Cancer Center, is also here with us. Also joining us from Exelixis are Mike Morrissey, our president and CEO, and Gisela Schwab, our chief medical officer and president of product development and medical affairs. Joining us from Ipsen are David Meek, chief executive officer, and Claude Bertrand, executive vice president of research and development and chief scientific officer. Today's agenda will include introductory comments from both Mike and David. Dr. Schwery will then review the CABOSUN results. Dr. Schwab will briefly speak about the other ESMO presentations on cabozantinib. And Dr. Paul will review the cabozantinib nivolumab phase 1 data. This will be followed by a question and answer session with Dr. Schwery, Paul, and Tanir, which will be moderated by Dr. Schwab. We'll then open the floor up to questions from our attending audience here in Copenhagen, and Dr. Bertrand will be available from the audience. For those of you listening in via the conference call or the webcast who would like to ask questions, please email them to me at ltreadway@exelixis.com. Before I turn the session over to Mike and David, I'll remind you all that during the course of this presentation, we'll be making forward-looking statements regarding the future events or the future performance of the company, including statements related to the clinical, therapeutic, or commercial potential of cabozantinib, regulatory development and submission strategies, the development path for cabozantinib, and commercial planning for CABOMEDICS. Actual events or results could, of course, differ materially. We refer you to slides 2 and 3 of the presentation for applicable cautionary language. And with that, I'll now turn it over to David and Mike. Thank you.
Thanks, Lindsay. Quick intro and welcome. Really pleased to have you all here tonight. I know it's been a busy couple of days. We have a lot of exciting data for both CABOSUN and the CABO-NEVO combination study that we're going to be talking about tonight. I want to thank our panelists. I know you guys are all super busy and had a very busy couple days here and had a lot of other options to be at tonight. So really want to thank you for coming tonight and helping us talk about the data. And I'm also very pleased to introduce David Meek and our colleagues from Ipsen. This is the first joint Exelixis-Ipsen investor media event, and I think it's a very good step forward in that collaboration that's now gotten off to a great start. So with that, David, want to say a few words?
Thanks, Mike. Good evening, everybody. On behalf of Ipsen, I'm really pleased to be here tonight and to be here with our Exelixis colleagues as well as our esteemed panel to talk about all the recent CABO data. It seems like just a couple of months ago, we were talking at ASCO about the full data release of METEOR, which was used as a basis for the FDA approval and the very recent EMA approval. So we're real excited about it, and we're real excited tonight about talking about CABOSUN as well as some combination data. At Ipsen, we couldn't be happier to be in the partnership with Exelixis. It's a great partnership. It's off to a great start. Great data always helps a partnership, though, doesn't it? So we're real excited about the data. And we are running full steam ahead. We just got approval just a few short weeks ago in Europe. So our mandate each and every day is to make CABO available to as many patients we can throughout Europe on a daily basis. We're real excited about the future development of CABO and our partnership with Exelixis. We want to maximize CABO as much as we can and add the greatest value to as many patients as possible. So thanks for being here tonight, and I'll turn it over to Gisela.
Thank you very much, David. So before moving to the data review of the presentations at ESMO this year, and in particular starting then with the CABOSUN data, I want to remind everybody of the current approval status. for Cabometyx, trade name for cabozantinib. It is currently approved in the United States for administration for the treatment of advanced renal cell carcinoma patients who have received prior anti-angiogenic therapy. Cabometyx, as David just mentioned, is also, as of September, 9th of September, approved in the EU for the treatment of advanced renal cell cancer patients in adults following prior VEGF-targeted therapy. I'd like to also refer you to the important safety information that is covered in the next two slides. I will not go through that in detail, but rather refer you to the relevant prescribing information. So with this, I would like to invite Dr. Tony Chueri to review the Cabozan data.
So thank you for having me today. Just presented this data, and it's my pleasure to present it again. So let me see this, how this works. So just as a reminder, this was an alliance with sponsorship from Exelixis, but this was an alliance, I would say, sponsored the GU committee at Alliance and supported by the NCI and the CTAP study. And members here are Alliance investigators, the Alliance statistician and the investigator who essentially put patient on study. So no need perhaps to review that cabozantinib is an oral VEGF MET-XL inhibitor that is currently approved for second line or later previously treated RCC patients. So we did evaluate here in our study untreated patients, so this was the difference with Meteor, and focused on poor and intermediate risk group, because these patients actually are much more an unmet medical need than good risk patients. And initially when we conceived the study, we had data from the phase one, and if you look at it, showed substantial activity in heavily pretreated patients. If you look at the baseline characteristic of that study published in the Annals of Oncology, they're mostly intermediate and poor, so when it do the same. The primary endpoint was PFS, and the secondary endpoint were safety, OS, and response rate by investigator assessment, although there will be future plan for independent review. So I want to put this data in context, because the devil is in the details, and give you an idea about the patient population. So let's put it in context. Let's not look at, let's say, a study that was done 10 years ago, but look at more contemporary studies that put sunitinib, let's say, as a control arm. For that, the RECORD 3 trial, which is a very large randomized phase 2, is an example of a trial of everolimus versus sunitinib frontline, and this study is from 2014. And the famous COMPARSA study, which is a non-inferiority trial of sunitinib versus versus pazopanib. And as you can see here, what Cabozan did in terms of differences, the major differences here is that we did not have patient with favorable risk. The patient with poor risk are slightly higher. All our patients are intermediate and poor risk. We had patients with ECOG performance status of 2, 13%, and certainly more bone metastases. And we know patients with bone metastases actually fare a worse prognosis and have less responses to TKI. So again, no patient with favorable prognosis. And we know these patients now, well-known, their response rate, their PFS, their OS, is much higher on VEGF-targeted therapy. Higher rate of ECOG-2, poor prognosis patient, higher rate of bone metastases. And these are the results. These are the curves I just showed. Median PFS with cabozantinib, let's see why this is not moving, was 8.2 months, and median PFS with sunitinib, 5.6 months. Hazard ratio 0.69, stratified P value, log rank was 0.01. And actually, interestingly, we published out of a database, an academic database, that we have of 20 plus centers that we started called the International Metastatic Database Consortium that actually came up with these risk factors. We published data from at some point, I think in the BJC, about patients treated with target therapy, mostly sunitinib, with intermediate and poor risk. And it was 5.6 months. So this is not far off. Response rate, was it different? Sunitinib, 18%. I do believe that that's a reasonable number. In patients with poor and intermediate risk, was enriched in bone metastases. Actually, also, a large number of patients did not have prior nephrectomy. I believe the prior nephrectomy rate was 77%. The response rate of sunitinib was 18%, and with cabo, 46%, investigator assessed. What about overall survival? Median OS was 30.3 months with cabo, 21.8 months with sunitinib. You may have been in Dr. Escudier, who did a nice job for me looking at sunitinib OS in the modern era from IMDC. So he took it, he multiplied, of course, I mean, a statistician may not approve, but he multiplied 81%. And I'm sure any statistician here probably would is raising a lawsuit or something, 81. But 20 to 22 months frontline, I would say, VEGF TKI with sunitinib in poor and intermediate is reasonable. So the hazard ratio is 0.8, but I want to warn you, I don't have the follow, the median. The median follow-up, actually, this arm, I don't recall, but it's around 21, 22 months. So definitely at some point, this need to be updated, and there are plans for that. Okay. These are the subgroup analysis. Again, we're looking at small subgroup, but as you can see, the hazard ratios are less than one everywhere. The 95 confidence interval are pretty large when you go to small subgroup, like the poor risk, despite the numbers remain meaningful. What about the tumor shrinkage? That's something early look at the data and people that you have second scan on and have any you know, you have that scan, what did they have in terms of, you know, tumor shrinkage or increase, so waterfall plots. 87% of patients cabo-treated had some form of tumor reduction, I would say from 1% to 100%, compared to 43% in sunitinib-treated patients. And these are the OS curves at the end of the day. And if you follow the 20 months falls, you know, median here, follow-up, it's in the middle. So the curve do separate and separate later, but around, you know, 18, 20 months, which is the median follow-up, they converge. So certainly this need to be updated. More cycles in terms of cabozantinib given, same grade 3-4 events, dose reduction slightly higher, but same discontinuation. And there wasn't, at least in this study, any new signals, any new toxicities that are different, let's say, higher rate than reported perforation or any new side effects, your typical side effects. Some are worse in terms of grade 3-4 events with cabo. Others are more pronounced, like fatigue with sunitinib. So greater exposure, similar rate of AEs, somewhat similar rate of AEs and discontinuation. So what are the treatment implications? If you look at the literature, sunitinib in modern, even in modern studies, PFS is 8 to 11 months. Of course, from the first Moser study in 2007, 11 months, which is predominantly only favorable and intermediate, 11 months. And with more modern, studies like Record 2 and COMPARS, it's between 9 and 10. 8 to 11, if you look at everything reported. I mentioned the PFS that we reported out of IMDC focusing on favorable and intermediate in targeted therapy-treated patients. Not all sunitinib, but the majority. The PFS difference, the hazard ratio, 31% decrease in the risk of death. Overall response rate is higher, similar safety profile. OS is not significant at this point. We're planning to update the OS. So I do believe that cabozantinib does represent a potential first-line treatment option in patients with advanced RCC. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Chouri.
So with that, I would just quickly like to cover the regulatory plans for cabozantinib on the basis of Cabozan. On the basis of the data just described by Dr. Choueiri, Exelixis intends to submit a supplemental sNDA based on those results. And we are currently working with the cooperative group, the Alliance, to transfer the data, the complete database, into Exelixis from the Alliance. We also have initiated a process for collecting images from the sites through the Alliance and are intending to perform an independent radiology review. And so these activities will allow us to prepare the data sets in accordance with regulatory expectations for a supplemental NDA to the FDA. In terms of timing for such a supplemental NDA, that depends on a variety of factors, and at this current time, we are not providing a timeline, but we will certainly update you as we learn more about the process and a little bit further down the line. Regarding Ipsen's plans, our partner Ipsen is in discussion with the EMA to define the regulatory path and submission for a variation, and that will occur simultaneously with the US efforts. So I'd like to talk briefly about all the cabozantinib presentations at ESMO. I will not go into a lot of detail, but I wanted to mention a few of them. There's obviously the Cabozan data that you just heard about. There were four abstracts that covered Meteor data, and importantly, two important subgroup analyses were shown yesterday in the poster presentation session. One was an analysis by tumor burden, so patients with lower or higher tumor burden were assessed, and also patients with visceral involvement or bone metastases. And again, like in previous subgroup analyses, Dr. Powles, who presented this data set, was showing a very consistent picture across these different subgroups with a benefit for cabozantinib over everolimus for overall survival, progression-free survival, and objective response rate. And so that is certainly very consistent with what has been shown for other subgroups. Likewise, Dr. Tanir presented in the same session an analysis of regional assessments for North America, Europe, and Asia Pacific. And again, there was benefit across all the subgroups, and certainly we can discuss that more in the discussion session. Colin Hessel, our head of biostatistics, showed a detailed trial design presentation. And Dr. Powell presented the quality of life analysis that essentially showed that the quality of life with cabozantinib was very similar to that observed with everolimus. And importantly, when patients progressed on both arms, the quality of life decreased dramatically. And so that highlights the importance of extending progression-free survival. And in line with that, the time to treatment, to deterioration on treatment was statistically significantly longer with cabozantinib as compared to everolimus. And certainly Dr. Powell will be able to shed more light on that if you have further questions. Also, and very important, I think, in our discussion here, we had another presentation in a poster discussion session yesterday that was authored by Andrea Apollo from the NCI, and Dr. Powell is a co-author on that presentation. It covered the phase 1b study of cabozantinib in combination with nivolumab in patients with advanced genitourinary tumors. That is certainly a very important study, and I'd like to invite Dr. Powell to give a brief overview of the results. Thank you.
Great. Well, it's an honor to be here today on behalf of Exelixis and Ipsen, sharing with you some results from our data set pertaining to the combination of cabozantinib and nivolumab. As Dr. Schwab pointed out, this is a phase 1b clinical trial exploring the combination of cabozantinib with nivolumab. Importantly, the study also includes cohorts of patients who will receive the triplet combination of cabozantinib, nivolumab, and ipilimumab together. This is an NCI-CTEP-sponsored trial. Dr. Andrea Paolo is the principal investigator. I and several others are participating in what I think is a very important study coming on the heels of the CABOSUN data. Now, this study includes two cohorts. A cohort will be treated with the combination of cabozantinib and nivolumab. There are two dose levels of cabozantinib being explored, 40 milligrams and 60 milligrams. And nivolumab is dosed, as we have been until recently, in metastatic renal cell carcinoma at 3 milligrams per kilogram IV every 3 weeks. And it's important to note that an expansion arm is currently recruiting from this trial, and I'll make mention of that in just a moment. The triplet regimen that we're exploring looks at cabozantinib at 40 milligrams, nivolumab at 3 milligrams per kilogram, and ipilimumab at 1 milligram per kilogram. So this regimen of nivolumab and ipilimumab in combination mimics the regimen that's being looked at now in the phase 3 setting. Now, these arms are both going to include expansion cohorts that are specific to patients with urothelial carcinoma and renal cell carcinoma, so we'll really be able to do a deep dive in these subpopulations of patients. I do want to spend a little bit of time dwelling on the patient characteristics from this clinical trial. The median age of this group was 55. As you might expect, in a genitourinary cancer population, there's a male preponderance. 21 patients were male, 3 females. As we look across the study population, I want to emphasize this. This is a heavily pretreated population. 3 patients in the series had a KPS of 70%, 12 had a KPS of 80%. So these were patients certainly that had been suffering from complications from prior therapies. In terms of tumor type, I also want to emphasize that several of these histologies that we explored are exquisitely rare. These are areas of unmet need. And in many of these disease subtypes, we, for instance, have some modest data with chemotherapy, but really no established standards. And I would suggest that some good representative examples of that would be urothelial adenocarcinoma. Squamous cell carcinoma of the bladder, for instance, right now truly represents a very unmet need. Refractory germ cell tumors and trophoblastic tumors would also fall into that category. And you can see that they really made up the preponderance of patients in this study. Again, I can't emphasize this enough. This was a very heavily pretreated population of patients. They received a range of 1 to 6 prior therapies. 10 patients in the series actually had 4 more prior therapies. And I think that that actually makes our results incredibly impressive. In this heavily pretreated population, again, taking rare histologies for where there is no established standard of care, we achieved an overall response rate of 43%. As you look across the curve here, this waterfall plot indicates several dose levels of nivolumab and cabozantinib that are color-coded. In gray is cabo at 40, nivo at 1, and that ranges up to red, which is cabo at 60 and nivo at 3. And you can see a broad range of responses across tumor types. I think it's particularly interesting to note what's happening in our bladder cancer cohort. So as I look across our bladder cancer patients that have been accrued thus far, what we're seeing is that 6 out of 8 patients have actually derived a response. So response would be indicated by the waterfall plot extending below the dashed line that I'm indicating here. So 6 out of 8 patients have derived a response to this therapy. Again, what makes this particularly impressive is that 2 of those bladder cancer patients actually had squamous cell histology. And if we're looking to at least a signal of activity in renal cell carcinoma, I think we're seeing that in our preliminary data set as well. One RCC patient with sarcomatoid renal cell was included in this cohort. Again, keep in mind sarcomatoid renal cell carcinoma is one of the most aggressive subtypes that the 3 of us see in the clinic. And so again, there we've encountered a response as well. So I'm incredibly enthusiastic about this data, especially in the face of CABOSUN. I think there's been a lot of interest in combination studies with IO and with cabozantinib now representing a frontline standard. I certainly think that it'll be interesting to use cabozantinib as a base in future combination studies with IO. What about toxicity profile? That's been a big question as we've approached this regimen. I would say that this regimen has been incredibly tolerable. I can, you know, convey that from personal experience from giving this regimen. In terms of grade 3 adverse events, those that occurred at a more than 10% frequency were decreased neutrophil counts, thromboembolic events, and fatigue. There's 1 grade 4 lipase increase. Keep in mind that lipase increases can be asymptomatic, not necessarily correlating with pancreatitis. There were no grade 3 or higher liver enzyme elevations. And through this experience, we've arrived at a dose for phase 2 exploration of cabozantinib at 40 milligrams plus nivolumab at 3 milligrams per kilogram. So right now, I'm actively recruiting patients, as are the other sites participating in this study, to two expansion cohorts. One will include patients with metastatic urothelial carcinoma that have received one prior therapy. Another will include patients with metastatic renal cell carcinoma. So I'm hoping to share that data with you in the near future. Thank you.
Thank you so much. That was a wonderful overview. Thank you. So we'll now go on to questions. I have a few prepared questions that I wanted to ask the panel about, and then we later on open it up to the floor here to ask questions from the audience. So maybe starting with you, Dr. Chouhary, you described the patient population in Cabo-San very well with the intermediate and poorest population per the IMDC criteria. Can you go a little bit further maybe and talk about the proportion of patients that represents in the overall renal cell population and also maybe what particular clinical challenges they might represent?
Yeah, actually, this is a good question. You know, I would say that these population, the population of intermediate and poor risk, represent anywhere between 70%, 80%, depending on the, you know, data you have. And these patients are usually tougher to treat. We can see in every reported paper, when you look at the subgroup analysis per MSKCC or IMDC criteria, it's striking that those 25, 30% favorable prognosis have so much prolonged PFS and overall response rate, as well as OS compared to the rest of the population, where the intermediate is in between, more so toward the poor, and there is, of course, the poor risk population. So we focus on intermediate and poor, and as I said, it's an unmet need. I don't think these are patients that you can observe. Now, adding to that, on top of that, that's why I think it's really poor, but some of them while being intermediate classification, that doesn't, take in consideration things like nephrectomy status, which was 23% of patients didn't have prior nephrectomy, doesn't take in consideration, ECOG-2, doesn't take in consideration also the fact that many of these patients also have bone metastases, which, you know, alone by itself, even when you stratify, and we showed that from IMDC, even when you look at the good risk, patient stratified by good risk, intermediate or poor, bone metastases, yes, no, in each portend a worse prognosis. So it's kind of, we went into the granularity, of the data.
Great. Thank you. Now, you described, just now that these patients are doing less well on sunitinib, as has been covered in the IMDC experience. Are there further thoughts to add, Dr. Paul?
I would say that Tony perhaps cited the most relevant publication from the IMDC pertaining to performance of frontline therapies. I would also add that Tony also added the caveat that, of course, the inclusion of ECOG performance status 2 patients is one of the other big differences in the context of Cabo-San that might account for some of the variations that we're seeing.
Great. Thank you. Okay. To our knowledge, obviously, this is the first time that a compound has actually shown a superior profile to sunitinib in the first-line treatment of RCC. And so I'd be interested, Dr. Tournier, if you could give us your thoughts of the potential significance of such a finding for the treatment in RCC going forward.
Thank you, Dr. Schwab, for the question. I think I'd like to also add to what's been said, because, again, to focus on those patients who have poor risk and intermediate risk disease, I think it's also important to quote the literature with temsirolimus. Temsirolimus or Toricel, which is was a Wyeth drug and it's a Pfizer drug, has level one evidence for poor risk patients by the NCCN guidelines as well as by the European guidelines based on a global ARCC trial that compared temsirolimus versus interferon versus the combination of these two drugs. And the response rate of temsirolimus treated patients was 8%. And the median progression-free survival was 5.4 months. And of course, the survival there, this is, data from the early 2000. The publication came out in in 2007, in May 2007, we didn't have too many drugs at the time, so there were no post-temsirolimus therapies that patients received. So the median OS there was 10.9 months. So if you look at a drug that's an mTOR inhibitor that is in every guideline, level one evidence for patients with poor risk, the results are really, in my opinion, not adequate, not effective therapy. So when you have a new TKI, such as cabozantinib, that targets the two important relevant pathways that tumors that are poor risk, intermediate risk, have, which is c-MET and AXL, this becomes an important study, in my opinion, that one should really pay attention to, because the results are impressive, with a progression-free survival of 8.2 months versus, as I said, 5.4 months with temsirolimus and 5.6 months. So again, to put it in context, temsirolimus level one evidence in poor risk RCC, the median progression-free survival was very comparable, in line with what you get with sunitinib. And here you have a drug, cabozantinib, that produces a significant improvement of PFS and an impressive 46% response rate compared to 18% with sunitinib and 8% of what you get with temsirolimus. So I think, in my opinion, cabo-sun is, I like to look at it or portray it as cabo is a rising sun.
Thank you. Now, turning to overall survival, and Dr. Choueiri mentioned that the data are preliminary at this time. Nevertheless, there appears to be some separation of the curves. Dr. Paul, how do you view the curves and the currently available data?
Yeah, the hazard ratio of 0.8 is what really influences me. And I think that in this case, we've seen the benefit in progression-free survival. We've seen the benefit in terms of response rate. And although early, I think there is actually a trend towards OS benefit here. I mean, if anything, this is perhaps icing on the cake when it comes to establishing cabozantinib as the preferred frontline therapy.
Great. Right. And Dr. Choueiri, do you want to talk about the follow-up? You mentioned it briefly in the presentation, but there was a lot of censoring in the middle of the curve.
Yeah, there was a lot of censoring. I believe the median follow-up was the same as the, as the sunitinib median. So there should be, follow-up 6 to 12 months more. And, the hazard ratio could get, lower. It's very refreshing to see that it's not going in the wrong direction. We do have studies that show the PFS benefit, small PFS, but statistically significant, if you remember, with TIVO-1, tivozanib versus sorafenib frontline, which shouldn't be part of any treatment arms as control in frontline with sorafenib. But anyhow, that study was presented at ASCO a few years ago, showed the PFS benefit with tivozanib, but actually the OS was favoring sorafenib for many reasons. So it's good here to see hazard ratio of 0.8 and a median survival of 9 months difference. So with further update, it's possible that these 95 confidence interval and the hazard ratio became more favored. I would love to see that. So I think the discussion, will be closed and the data will be completely bulletproof. And like my good friend, Dr. Paul, who came up with the word trifecta, we'll have a trifecta, with cabo-sun, like with mitomiteor.
Great, thank you. Turning to tolerability and safety for a moment, we've seen the adverse event profile that Dr. Choueiri just presented with the 60 milligram cabozantinib daily dose on a continuous basis and the traditional sunitinib dosing of 4 weeks on, 2 weeks off at 50 milligrams. Could you give us your opinion on the comparative tolerability of these agents in the population, Dr. Paul?
Yeah, sure. So, I've actually been surveying a lot of my colleagues. I've been involved in the clinical development of cabozantinib from the phase 1 clinical trial onwards. So I've been using it for many years now. But since the approval, I've been really trying to gauge the opinions of my community-based oncology colleagues and whether or not they're having difficulties utilizing cabozantinib from day to day. I have to say that what they've described to me is something that I've experienced, which is that if a patient has sort of learned the toxicity profile of a VEGF-directed therapy in the frontline setting, they're able to accommodate it once again in the second-line setting. And I think that that experience would probably ring true, you know, for a frontline therapy as well. I can't imagine why folks wouldn't be able to accommodate toxicities over time.
Great, thank you. Now, Dr. Tania, you have treated many patients in your practice and in the METEOR trial as well. Could you maybe comment a little bit on the management of adverse events through dose adjustments?
Sure. I've had the opportunity to treat about 80 patients with cabozantinib, 16 of those in the context of the METEOR trial, and then subsequently off protocol. In the U.S., we have access to cabozantinib, in fact, even before it was FDA approved in April. So I can say that patients with renal cell carcinoma who are used to receiving sunitinib and pazopanib and received cabozantinib in the second line did not find it anything different or more challenging to treat and manage the adverse events compared to what they have experienced previously with sunitinib and other TKIs. So I think, obviously, the physicians and the nurses and the advanced practice providers who take care of these patients have to have a knowledge and experience in managing these adverse events. And if they have that, the management is obviously straightforward, managing the diarrhea, managing fatigue, managing hypertension. This is really, as Tony presented the data, there was no really, there were no differences that were significant between the two agents vis-a-vis adverse events. So you see basically the same adverse events. And the discontinuation rate, I think it's important to, again, underline this, that 20% in both arms discontinued because of adverse events. So really, there is nothing really special or one has to take a special care to manage these adverse events that you would do normally with the other TKIs.
Great, thank you. Now turning to a bigger question on how the RCC landscape, in your opinion, is going to evolve over time. There are many trials ongoing, and obviously Cabozan is now one available data point, others are to come. Could you maybe, all of you in sequence, give us your opinions? Dr. Treri, do you want to start?
Yeah, I mean, I think in the absence of clinical trials, you know, and if I can get, let's say I have, you know, a choice of all drugs in Boston, I am very comfortable starting with cabozantinib and going second line with nivolumab, then the combination of lenvatinib, everolimus. Obviously, things may change with the adjuvant data that was just presented. Although I think this is not a slam dunk, having a disease-free survival by central review and not by investigator assessment without an OS benefit. It's all going to depend on the regulators. But that would be, you know, my paradigm. Obviously, it could change depending on the result of these of the trials that have sunitinib as a control arm, which brings me to, you know, a very valid point that Dr. Escudier put, that if we update later on in, let's say, 6 months, 9 months, our survival and our numbers, and let's say a new IO combination comes out that is superior to sunitinib, but along the same lines, it's not good to compare across arm. But for example, the nivolumab plus ipilimumab combination, that primary endpoint, despite it will allow good risk patient, the primary endpoint is an intermediate and poor. So you are going to have, although it's, and it's by the IMDC criteria, not by the MSKC criteria. So are you're going to have in a sort of a validation of Cabo-San in a larger scale with response rate, PFS, et cetera. So if that beats sunitinib, but it's in the same range or slightly higher or slightly less than cabozantinib, can we say it does beat cabozantinib? And should we make now the switch to cabozantinib as the control arm? I think the field is going so fast that, you know, It's hard to say, but again, I'm comfortable frontline cabo, nivo, and lenvatinib, everolimus, or actually axitinib if the patient is not fit enough.
Great.
Yeah. I'll keep my comments brief. Yeah. I largely agree with Dr. Choueiri. I really do think we're going to have to revisit sunitinib as a control arm in a number of these comparative trials. And I do think that that really reflects the fact that now cabozantinib is a frontline standard for us. You know, when I get back to clinic on Wednesday, I certainly think that I'm going to be offering it frontline on the basis of the data that we've seen here at this meeting. I would probably also go to the length of saying that, you know, when it comes to my good risk patient population, I would also feel comfortable offering cabozantinib in that context. Mm-hmm. I know that the three of us up here on the stage are obsessed with the biology of renal cell carcinoma, and I can't think of any good reason for which cabozantinib wouldn't also yield the same benefit in a good risk population. And I think we'll be forced to do that, as Tony pointed out, based on some of the studies that are being conducted right now in the phase three setting. So with that in mind, I'll probably be offering cabozantinib across the board irrespective of IMDC risk.
Thank you. Dr. Tenney?
So here is, I think, what patients want to know and what I think is important to mention. There will be some skeptical who will say, well, why not, since you don't have OS yet, the sort of significant difference in OS from cabo-sun, why not still consider sunitinib in first line and then you give them cabozantinib in the second line per Meteor data? Here is my answer, and I think this is what's important to tell our patients and our colleagues, and I think you, investors and media. Even at MD Anderson, where patients are, come to MD Anderson because they're motivated, they want to go to a center of excellence, they want to be treated with the best. The dropout rate from first line to second line, in the real world, is, trials or no trials. We're not talking about patients who are selected for clinical trial participation. But anybody that comes to MD Anderson, we looked at the data, we published it, a few years ago. 60% only of patients go from first line to second line. So if you look at that, and if you give a weaker drug in the first line, such as sunitinib, in poor risk, intermediate risk, you're not going to give a chance to that patient to get a second chance with cabozantinib or any other drug in the second line. So why not give your best drug up front in first line? So that's the important argument. The other important thing to mention is that here is drug that has shown superior results with PFS, which was the primary endpoint, objective response rate, which was secondary endpoint, and a 9 months difference in OS, which was secondary endpoint, although the hazard ratio hasn't crossed the threshold yet, it's 0.8, and comparable adverse events or safety, similar safety. So cabo-sun, and any phase three trial, as was suggested by Dr. Escudier, to enroll several hundred patients to do another cabo-sun tour, let's call it, with phase three, with hundreds of patients treated with cabozantinib versus sunitinib, to confirm the results of cabo-sun, no, I do not believe the data is going to show that cabozantinib will ever be inferior to sunitinib. Not certainly by PFS or by response rate, and I do not believe the OS will flip, and then all of a sudden, patients treated with sunitinib will have a better outcome. And since we see that adverse events are similar, so why not provide your best drug up front when you know that you're not going to harm the patients, and in fact, you might help them and give them that chance in the first line, then the second line. So in my practice, I am embracing the results of cabo-sun. I will treat my patients with clear cell RCC who have poor risk and intermediate risk by IMDC criteria with cabozantinib in the first line. And I agree with what Tony mentioned. After they get cabozantinib in first line, then they get a chance to go to nivolumab in the second line. And then, after that, obviously, lenvatinib everolimus, if it's available for patients, I think that will be an option. So cabozantinib is, in my opinion, a new standard of care for first-line patients with clear cell RCC, with poor risk and intermediate risk.
Thank you. Switching now to combination approaches, and we've heard the data from the study that Dr. Paul described, and that founder identified a tolerable active, it appears, in bladder cancer combination dose with 40 milligrams of cabozantinib and full dose of nivolumab. Now, that is obviously a combination that could be thought about in other indications, not just in bladder cancer. Could you give us your thoughts on combination approaches and how you potentially see combinations play forward with cabozantinib and potentially IO compounds or other?
Absolutely. You know, I think the key with, you know, these phase one data sets is really to evaluate tolerability, of course. And, you know, I've been involved in some of the experiences looking at the sunitinib-nivolumab combination, the pazopanib-nivolumab combination. I think many of us are familiar with the prohibitive rates of hepatotoxicity and GI-related toxicity that were seen in those initial efforts. I think what our effort demonstrates is, A, the safety and tolerability of cabozantinib with nivolumab, and I can't fathom why that wouldn't apply to cabozantinib with any IO. And B, really outstanding activity. I was not anticipating seeing such a high response rate in all of these exquisitely rare and aggressive tumor types. So I think that that high response rate, and particularly the high response rate in our bladder cancer subset, I think is great rationale for moving forward with this.
Dr. Chouin?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think these are the tumors that Andrea Apollo treated are actually tumors that, you know, these are the consults we don't really like to see, or we see and we send immediately to the phase one. And they're very heavily pretreated. Monty showed you that most of the patients had four or more line of therapy. And they're not just hard to treat. We understand nothing about their biology. You'll be lucky to see in the literature some exome sequencing that shows mutation in a gene or two or three that don't mean anything. So trophoblastic tumor, germ cell tumor, those are either ineligible or, you know, post-transplant. Uracal cancer, which we still don't understand. Sometimes we treat it like actually colorectal cancer. But if you focus on the bladder cohort, it's a clean cohort, and you have a benchmark. You have a benchmark because we know, let's say, approved drug, atezo, response rate 15%, PFS 2.5 months, but let's go by response, 15%. Cabo, response rate in bladder urothelial cancer is 19-20%. So seeing 67%, I understand it's a small number of patients, but these are heavily pretreated. I mean, it's very interesting, especially that that patient, if you noticed here and you were close enough to the screen, the patient that had PD on the urothelial is actually a patient that was considered SD because of the cavitation in the lesion, and the lesion increased. And we see that on cabozantinib, you know, from time to time. So this patient would be interesting to see what their survival, especially if they can be kept on therapy. And with that, what is interesting about the combo that, you know, is its safety in terms of toxicity on the liver. The LFTs, you know, toxicity, I believe grade 3, 4 were zero. And this is not what was seen with sunitinib and pazopanib when both were combined with nivolumab. And as you notice, the combos of sunitinib with nivolumab and pazopanib and nivolumab, you don't hear about because, to my knowledge, it's not going forward.
Great. Dr. Tinney.
I'd like to focus the discussion again, in my opinion, on renal cell carcinoma, which is what I treat at MD Anderson. I think cabozantinib has raised the bar for future phase three trials, certainly in the first line. And I see the future as combinations rather than monotherapy versus monotherapy. So I do not think we should invest in resources to do a phase three trial of a monotherapy versus monotherapy in the first line. So I think the future is here, and the future is going to be a combination of a drug such as cabozantinib, which is, in my opinion, the now the gold standard of a TKI in RCC, in clear cell at least. And I do share the view and the expressed by Monty about I would not just focus on treating just poor risk and intermediate risk, but expand it also to the good risk, because there is a rationale. Cabozantinib is a potent VEGFR receptor, VEGFR inhibitor. So it is, and you saw from the adverse events, it causes hypertension similar to sunitinib. So I think there's no reason not to believe that it will be also effective in the good risk. So the future is going to be a combination of an immune checkpoint inhibitor plus cabozantinib. That's the study to do versus a standard of care. And I think, you know, with the results from Cabo-San, again, phase three trials are going to be now challenging for a newcomer to the market to design a trial where you're going to use cabozantinib as your control arm rather than sunitinib, and you're going to be aiming for higher than the 8.2 months median PFS for poor risk intermediate risk. And so I think this is going to be the challenge for future you know, phase three trials in the space. But I do think that from the data Monty presented, cabozantinib is well tolerated in combination with nivolumab at the doses he showed you. So I think that should be the trial moving forward in RCC and in other GU tumors and other tumors where we think that blocking the pathway of VEGFR and c-MET axial is relevant.
I want to add that, you know, yeah, it's good to be kind of, you know, consensus builder and just have a single agent, let's say Nivo versus Cabo second line. But it just simply is not going to happen. The field is advancing really so fast. If this was an era, let's say, where we did not have the IO drug and did not have the TKI, where all we had to play with is carboplatin, taxane, and when gemcitabine came, everybody gave them, you know, just, you know, before pronouncing the patient. So that would be different, but I don't think the field is that. And why do I think that the community, I talk to the RCC community, to the patient, to academic centers, to, you know, community practice. If this was, you know, was interesting to know what the second line, you would have seen in everolimus versus axitinib phase three. The field did stall, actually, when axitinib was approved January 2011, until the approval of nivolumab, the field, we didn't know what to do with nivolumab, it's going to be positive, CheckMate 25 study or not. But for 4 years, we had time to do such studies, and it wasn't even proposed. So I don't think there'll be cabo-nivo. I don't think the field is going, you know, through that way. Now, if you live in a country that's different, where they're going to approve two therapies only, and they need a trial in this particular country or this particular union where you have to depend and you cannot choose whether cabo or nivo, let's say the front line standard is still sunitinib or pazopanib, that's different. But we're not. Cabo now is a different game. It's moving to the front line.
Great. Thank you so much. We'd now like to open the floor for questions. Please.
So, can I start? It's John Saunier with William Blair. I have two questions. One, Dr. Chiarelli, is actually about the design and conduct of the study. A question we've gotten is, were there any imbalances or abnormalities at all in the study? One thing that was pointed out to us is the time on Sutent. I think it was only 2 months. Is that typical as to what you might have expected in this patient population?
You mean 2 months, the duration on therapy?
Correct.
Yeah, there was, I mean, less cycles, you know, given patient came off because of, you know, a lot of them for, you know, rapid progression didn't finish, you know, their cycles. So I don't think this was an imbalance. I look more so as imbalances in the baseline characteristic, intermediate poor, bone metastases, you know, age, prior nephrectomy, we look at that, ECOG-2, and I think it was balanced. And, you know, 157 patients remains a smaller study, but it's not that small. I mean, we saw the everolimus combination with lenvatinib. Actually, both arm were compared, the single-agent everolimus and the combo, it's 100 patients. So I think it's okay. I don't see any major imbalances.
I appreciate it. And I guess just one additional question. Maybe the pink elephant in the room, there was a suggestion from the discussant that maybe a phase three is required, maybe overall survival is required for approval. Two questions, are there any drugs marketed and approved in the frontline setting that required overall survival, number one? And number two, do you agree? Thank you.
Yeah. No, I don't. I mean, I was sitting next to the discussant who happened to be a very close friend. Dr. Escudier. So I don't agree with him at all. Now, look, it's in the hand of the regulatory agencies. So I think a drug is available. You have two endpoint met and a third that will be, you know, analyzed later. In metastatic disease, we have accepted, and we should continue to accept, progression-free survival as a valid endpoint, especially when your drug is sunitinib. I mean, could you have run a study with a control arm like sorafenib? I would not have personally accepted, but we were seeing up to very recently large phase three trial, the AGILE study, which is phase three but smaller, axitinib versus sorafenib, and tivozanib versus sorafenib study, where they put sorafenib, which is an inferior treatment. You know, so I think the hype is that this is the first time that you provide superiority over sunitinib. It's a randomized phase two, everything trending the same direction. The drug is available second line. The biology, this is not another VEGF TKI. I think Dr. Jonas, with his paper from MD Anderson, Nizar's colleague, showed it clearly that MET and XL cooperate together. This is a different type of TKI. I think the evidence is there to use this drug first line.
Dr. Tanu, you wanted to comment?
Sure. I thank you for the question. It's a very valid question. If I'm a minister of health, I would look at this as waste of resource to do a phase three trial to confirm Cabo-San's data, because there is no way doing a phase three trial is going to show that cabozantinib is going to be inferior than sunitinib. So if the drug cabozantinib is already on the market, it's helping already patients who are in the second line, and produced OS, PFS, and response rate, and is equally tolerable, similarly tolerable to sunitinib. Again, as I mentioned, it's incumbent on us, physicians, as well as, you know, investors and media and society, to say, you know, why take the chance of going with sunitinib in the first line in these cohorts, these poor risk, intermediate risk patients? And then 40% of them may not get a chance to go to second line when you can offer them a drug in first line that is clearly showing PFS, response rate, equally tolerable, and there is a trend for survival that may become positive with future follow-up. So in my opinion, I have convinced myself, and I have already made a decision that it is appropriate, it's the right thing to do, it's what patients demand. And I think in the U.S., you will see that even if, I mean, again, as Tony mentioned, it's in the hands of the regulatory agency to decide whether they'll give cabozantinib a first-line indication. I think patients are advocates, are strong advocates. You know, in the U.S., we have strong advocacy for patients. They're going to push, they're going to demand to push their insurance companies to allow cabozantinib in first line. So it's going to come. And I think there will be many of us who will prescribe it without hesitation to our patients.
Just a really quick comment. You know, there is a place where the bar is high and where it is overall survival, and that's in the adjuvant setting. You know, so today we saw two back-to-back presentations, and there wasn't much commentary on OS from the S-TRAC trial. But if you really dig deep in the New England Journal of Medicine publication and the supplementary appendix, you'll see two completely overlapping survival curves. You know, now, if you look at the data that Tony presented today, I actually think that there was an encouraging trend, and it's reflected in the hazard ratio. But we're in a different setting. That frontline metastatic setting, progression-free survival is really the bar that we need to meet. But I mean, it's always great to see that OS trend.
Great. Next question.
Right, now we go. Michael Schmidt with Leerink Partners. A follow-up on trial conduct. There were some questions earlier today on the use of the one-sided p-value. And can you maybe comment on that and whether you might have to use more stringent statistics in the submission?
No, I mean, what we wanted to target is superiority, as simple. And this has been seen. Even if we are more, conservative, with a p-value of 0.01, it will become 0.02. So I don't think this is a major issue. Actually, what we should go for, and as you may have seen, that we haven't put p-values for OS, neither for response rate, despite this is statistically significant, is there's a lot of data when you have statistician. We have a wonderful statistician, you know, on the team who's very, you know, who worked very closely with the late Dan Sargent, who passed away unfortunately recently, who really designed studies when you're not powered for something like overall survival and you don't power your study for response rate, because you really don't know where this is going to go. You have to go by PFS. The majority of the data is powered for PFS in the literature. Everyone feel uncomfortable, and this is the American Statistical Association new guidelines that, of course, I don't read. But to use the 95 confidence interval and the hazard ratio interpreted and look the whole curve rather than the p-value. And that's why, you know, even though I suggested to the statistician to have a p-value for both the OS and for, you know, something like the response rate, said, look, the details are in the 95 confidence interval. And for response rate, they do not overlap, which means they're significant.
I think this is a great question. I asked that question, actually, a few days ago. I think I had a discussion with the head of statistics at Exelixis. And he provided me compelling, convincing evidence that if we had used what you had suggested, a two-sided test, the results would have been still significant. So I think that's an important question. Obviously, it would have required maybe, to do this, you know, maybe more patients. And that's, and again, the question of one-sided, rate versus two-sided is to look at, is one versus the other. You're going to look at just cabozantinib is better than sunitinib, or vice versa. Either drug is better than the other. So, but I was convinced after looking at the calculations he did for me that even if we had done that with a 2T, two-sided, it would have still been positive.
Great, thanks. And then one more, Gisela, you already commented on your regulatory plans, but could you just give us some more color on your interactions with regulators and, again, sort of what you'll need to accomplish before submission or in order to
sure.
submit?
Sure. So the first steps I outlined already a little bit earlier. We are working with the Alliance to transfer the data into Exelixis, the whole database into Exelixis. And we are also corroborating through an independent radiology review for which we are now collecting, or in the process of collecting the scans from the sites, the PFS observation. And so these are the key steps, I think, that we need to complete. Obviously, we have discussions with the FDA as to the scope of the submission and so on. But I think these are the key steps that are first. And I think with that, we then will be in a position to put together an application and a data format that is acceptable to regulatory agencies to support a supplemental NDA.
I have two questions. Dr. Salia, you did your study mainly in, I heard you said, Asia and America. Did you see any differences in race?
Oh, for me. Who's that for? Is that the question addresses the regional differences?
Yes.
For Meteor? And
yes.
There was a poster yesterday that Dr.
Tini
presented.
Yeah, so I think the benefit of cabozantinib over everolimus was seen in all regions. So regardless of, race, I think what the differences we saw when comparing, Europe and North America versus Asia was that Asians had, surprisingly fewer side effects than patients in the other regions of the world. And I think it's because patients in Asia were less previously treated because they didn't have access to as many drugs as, say, U.S. patients. So they had, as you saw from the Meteor, about 29% of patients treated with on Meteor had two or more prior therapies in Asia. Just about most patients had only one prior therapy. And maybe that explains why they had fewer adverse events. But in terms of efficacy, it was seen in all regions.
And you said in your previous answers that if you were the Minister of Health, I have a question for you as Minister of Health as well. If you look at the cost per quali, if you look at the cabozantinib and the nivolumab, the combination or cabo separate, how would you make your decision as a ministry, as a Minister of Health?
In terms of which of the two to use, is that?
Money-wise.
Money-wise? Well, you know, it's always cheaper to use an oral agent over an intravenous agent. Patients like to take an oral agent anytime rather than get an IV agent every 2 weeks. And, you know, if you look at cost, and we have done this analysis, actually. We have done this analysis. Cabozantinib is cheaper than nivolumab, much cheaper than lenvatinib everolimus, which is in the U.S. average wholesale price is $30,000. So if you look at cost, I'm a Minister of Health, I look at cost, I would go, cost meaning dollars or euros or kronas, cabo is more cost effective than nivolumab, than lenvatinib everolimus. And I think if you look at convenience, again, I think most patients, I tell my patients, you know, I have this, what would you rather do? And a majority would say, well, I'd like to take an oral agent, you know, less frequent visits to MD Anderson, and nobody would like to be stuck with a needle and or have a port and get intravenous therapy. So I think the checklist, my checklist is check for cabo on these two issues. The combo Nivo plus cabo, I think we'll have to do the study and show that it is better than, you know, the drugs sequentially. I think this is what people are going to ask. Is cabo plus Nivo better than cabo followed by Nivo? And I think this is a valid question to ask, sequence versus combination. I think if we can demonstrate that my argument why you want to give your best therapy up front because of the dropout to second line, from first line to second line. So if we can show that a combination of cabozantinib plus nivolumab will increase the chance of patients having durable remissions and potential cure, I'm all for the combination, even at the cost, because obviously you're going to increase the cost. But then we'll have to show that it really may produce durable survival, durable remissions, and break the barrier of cure. And if we do that, then I think, as a Minister of Health, I'll say it's worth the money that we spend if we're going to cure patients.
Yeah, I would add that there is a lot of, preclinical data about cabozantinib cooperating and inducing an immune-permissive environment. There's a lot of data, and a lot of this data focus on Treg, on decreasing Treg, which is a well-known mechanism of resistance to sunitinib. So if it does decrease Treg, not only that's perhaps one of the reasons why it's better in terms of resistance and cooperate surely with, agents such as nivolumab or, nivolumab plus, lower dose ipilimumab. I think if we look, and I get that from my experience talking a bit to Bill Kalin, one of my former mentors and now really my colleague who just got the Lasker Award. And Bill, think about it anymore, doesn't see patient anymore, but think about it. He's like, look, how did we cure? Forget about the Gleevec, but how did we cure cancer? We cured cancer, BEP chemotherapy, SHOP-R, we added. We gave them a cocktail, a transplantation, et cetera, and even in HIV in combination. And again, I do think the experience we had initially with VEGF-TKI and mTOR inhibitor, both toxicity wasn't favorable, but learning now and having some side effects that perhaps, are not the same, autoimmune versus target therapy, and proceeding really very cautiously, perhaps you can induce remission that are durable and achieve, a tail of the curve. It is possible.
Great. Other questions?
Yeah, hi, Stephen Willey from Stiefel. So maybe just some questions for the physicians. Just wondering how you interpret today's data in the sense that it might be reflected in updated treatment guidelines sometime soon. And I guess to that extent, would you expect there to be a Category 1 or a 2A recommendation based on the on the study size and design.
Tony, would you?
Yeah, I think these guidelines are extremely, tricky. I sit on the NCCN. If you look at their category, it's just based on how much you agree and the data and what trial. If you look at some of the guidelines, also I've been involved with. A lot of it depends if the data is published or not. So I would wait on that. But I have no doubt that cabozantinib, based on that data, will be published at some point. But we will be part of the front line. Can you label it, level 1 or 2A or what? I mean, a lot of it gonna depend on the country, on the availability of other agent, and whether still people are going by what they think that should be always a phase 3, and a phase 3 is always better. But as Nizar explained, this is a waste of resources. He's the Minister of Health at the end of the day.
And then secondly, we talked to a lot of physicians who prefer to use pazopanib in frontline because of the tolerability profile. So just wondering how you think today's data might marginalize some of the pazopanib abuse as well. Thanks.
Do you want to take this?
Sure. Yeah. I could take a stab at that. I think that, if we sort of jump from, study to study to, help answer this, it might be helpful. So, Tony's data obviously shows benefit with cabozantinib over sunitinib. If we look to the comparison of sunitinib with pazopanib in the COMPARS trial, I mean, they seem to really be balanced on every level. Progression-free survival, overall survival. I would say that by and large, the toxicity profiles, had many similarities. So I can't fathom why we can't extrapolate from the data that Tony presented today that there might be superiority over our traditional VEGF TKIs in general with versus cabozantinib.
I'd like to jump in since you brought up pazopanib. I agree. I think pazopanib is the better tolerated of the two TKIs when you look at sunitinib and pazopanib from COMPARES. I'll mention to you that it's on the the clinicaltrials.gov. We are conducting a randomized phase 2 trial for patients with intermediate poor risk RCC, clear cell. So similar to Cabo, Sun, very very similar, where we're comparing pazopanib with temsirolimus. We're calling this TEMPA trial, temsirolimus, pazopanib. So TEMPA and Cabo Sun. So obviously the trial is ongoing, but we've treated 61 patients, and I haven't obviously shared this. But I looked at the data. We've done several interim analyses already. We're going to 90 patients to final target accrual, and I do not see a difference between temsirolimus and pazopanib in those two cohorts of intermediate risk, poor risk, in clear cell RCC. So that tells you, and I mentioned already, I already told you what I think of temsirolimus. Temsirolimus, you brought up the question level 1 versus category 2A, how the NCCN guidelines or other guidelines will look at it. So I look at level 1 evidence with temsirolimus, and I look at the results, and I say, in 2016 and beyond, to be content with a 5.4 months median PFS with temsirolimus in the same cohorts of patients, and response rate of 8%, and survival of 10.9 months. Of course, now, if temsirolimus is done today, the survival will be probably in the range of 22 months. Why would I accept temsirolimus and talk about it as level 1 evidence and use it for patients with in first line when, cabozantinib is clearly better? And like I said, already told you, it doesn't look like pazopanib is better than temsirolimus. So that convinced me that we really need for those cohorts of patients something beyond just VEGFR blockade. We really need c-MET and AXL blockade that's provided by cabozantinib. So hopefully I can, come to ESMO or ASCO and present the trial results of TEMPA once we have it completed. But looks like already the interim analysis do not show any striking differences between the two arms, and I'm not hopeful that pazopanib is going to really convince me that this is a good drug for poor risk intermediate risk. So we really needed cabozantinib, and I'm happy to see that cabozantinib is a good option for our patients right now with these, you know, risk groups.
Great. There was a question here. Sorry. First, see.
Okay, thank you.
And then we come back to you. Sorry.
Paul Troy with Barclays. If we could maybe return the discussion for a moment back to bladder, and my question is for Dr. Paul, but I'd also love to hear the other panelists' opinion as well. So, with respect to the the initial data you've seen with the IO cabo combination here, could you maybe recognizing there are certain caveats that it's an early stage study and numbers are limited, could you maybe give your view on the relative safety and adverse events differences between and how you think about that at this stage with the data available between the IO cabo combination versus the data we have on the IO plus IO combinations, and maybe some of the differences between the two groups potentially.
Sure.
And then
sure.
My second question is given what we what looks like a very impressive response rate so far in a heavily pretreated population, how you think about maybe the combination's potential efficacy in more earlier stages of treatment, whether it's second line or first line, and would there be, given that we have an approved agent in a pretreated population, would you think about survival data being figuring prominently in a potential regulatory path for a combination therapy there? Thank you.
I'm going to try to remember both of those questions, but I'll try to start with the first one. So, I believe your question hinged on IO versus potentially cabozantinib with IO. And I think that's a reasonable question. I can really speak to the data, which I've been involved in looking at nivolumab and ipilimumab in combination as an example of an IO-IO combination. That data is public. We presented it several times at ASCO and ESMO. And there, there were some issues with hepatotoxicity and GI-related toxicity. And bear in mind that the phase 3 clinical trial right now in renal cell carcinoma, which juxtaposes nivolumab and ipilimumab against sunitinib, was really formulated on the basis of the 22 patients that were dosed in the phase 1 experience at nivolumab 3 milligrams per kilogram and ipilimumab at 1 milligram per kilogram. There were also 22 patients who had the opposite dosing regimen, ipilimumab at 3, nivolumab at 1, and there were some pretty significant rates of hepatotox and GI tox. So I do have some concerns, and I am curious to see what the toxicity profile for IO-IO is going to look like in bladder and in renal cell in general. What I think our data set demonstrates is that the combination of cabozantinib with nivolumab, very importantly, didn't really yield those hepatotox or GI tox signals, which I feel, and I don't know if my panelists would agree with me here, are probably the most prohibitive amongst the spectrum of toxicities that we see with those combos. And you had a second question, too.
The question is, given the strong response rate you've seen here in a population that I think you indicated had three or four previous lines of therapy on average, how you think about the combination, advancing into second or first line, and would you need to, how important would survival data in the second line or front line be relative to response rates for a potential approval there, in your view?
Absolutely. So recall that waterfall plot that we showed. Again, keeping in mind this is a very heavily refractory population. 6 out of 8 patients with urothelial carcinoma had a response, 2 of those squamous cell histologies. So I was doing the math in my head. That's a 75% response rate, right? And that 75% response rate is above and beyond anything that I've actually seen at this meeting so far. So, we saw some other data sets for novel agents as monotherapy in some of the poster discussion sessions for urothelial carcinoma. I really do feel like this stands alone against those. So I'm incredibly enthusiastic about looking at IO plus cabo combinations in bladder.
Yeah, no, I would agree, and I think also I do bladder cancer a bit, and I do agree with that. I think that's very reasonable. I think the bar is very low with atezolizumab in terms of response rate and PFS, and I think it's an unmet need because I think after atezolizumab, I doubt that people will use another PD-1 or PD-L1 inhibitor. So if the frontline Durva plus Tremis study is negative or not much convincing, atezo is already approved before any other, agent, and, will continue to dominate the market. And what can we do on it? What's, you know, what can we do in terms of an active drug post atezo, or at least in combination with atezo, or you know, facing atezo. So I think the combo of cabo nivo here becomes extremely attractive with a very, 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 very low bar for success in metastatic second-line bladder. And I don't see anything beside cabo that is worth combining in terms of new target. What are you going to choose? Already progressed on a platinum doublet. A taxane? I'm not sure this is exciting. Vinflunin? Definitely less exciting, you know. Nothing else is coming except IOs, and cabozantinib has a 20%, 19% response rate. The other thing I would say, I would take it one step further. I have used and enrolled a lot of patients on CheckMate 14 or 16, the nivo-ipi versus Sutent. You know, and I see the drug well-tolerated.
You mean the phase 3?
The phase 3.
CheckMate 2 and 4.
14, yeah, 214. And I see with lower dose of ipilimumab, or perhaps with, you know, omitting the last dose of ipilimumab, I think that the regimen is well tolerated and has one of the advantages of inducing those durable responses. So if I want to take this to the next level, independent of the, because we definitely saw more, at least I've seen, and the data backs it, even those 22 patients, there's a synergy. Single agent ipilimumab, which the study of Steven Rosenberg, you know, was very high dose, but there are responses, 10-15%, with nivo single agent, 20%. So the response that was seen, some of these patients previously treated, around 50-60%, is very encouraging, and that's what I saw in clinic myself, and the toxicity is okay. But I think if you say this is, you know, this is interesting, it can induce those durable responses, and you want to add something on it, then cabozantinib is very, very reasonable. It doesn't need to be at the 60 milligram dose. I mean, I think I have to tell you, in my practice, you know, in Meteor, we went down, the dose intensity was 44. In my practice, I stand, the patient that are very healthy, at least in second line, haven't used it first line yet, that are very healthy, that are progressing very quickly, I start at 60. And someone that had problem, et cetera, I keep very close eye on the patient. I do start at 40, and you know, we call them frequently and see if we can play down with the dose. Go up, you know, if you don't have side effects, to 60, or alternate 40 with 60. Now we have tablet of 20, 40, and 60. I mean, why not? We still, 10 years after the approval of sunitinib, coming up with alternative regimen. Axitinib, we still go up and down on the dose by 1 milligram, et cetera, et cetera. So it doesn't need to be that 60 to preserve efficacy. I do not believe that. And I think once you go down, you know, if you don't have side effects at all, that's different. But with some side effects to 40, this will still be a combinable. That's probably the success to a combinable regimen.
Thanks. Please.
Thank you. I'll try and be quick. Just on cabozantinib, really. First of all, I just wanted Dr. Schwab, is it reasonable to assume that given the time it'll take to compile the information, the radiological reviews and so on, that you would have an opportunity to do the next overall survival analysis when you actually get around to filing the sNDA?
Yeah, I think that is a very good question, and we haven't decided on the exact cutoff for a next survival analysis, and it will also obviously be in collaboration with the Alliance. But I think it is reasonable that this is a data set, when available, would be made available to regulatory authorities.
Okay. And just secondly, we haven't really discussed post-progression therapies in the Cabozantinib trial. I just wonder whether there's enough patients on there that you may have some bias that might prevent, if you like, the hazard ratio improving from 0.8.
Because you mean collecting, like we did on Meteor, collecting the number of systemic therapy after?
Well, I mean, I guess the possibility that those the patients that might become eligible for nivolumab or lenvatinib, yeah, everolimus, and they simply don't see the same improvement when you measure more patients.
So we will have data on subsequent line of therapy, collecting it, you know, activity. I don't believe there'll be, you know, imbalances, but I see your point. I mean, we have to do that exercise and see if the patient, this 9 months difference of survival, is it because patient had more lines of therapy later? So we have to do that exercise. I agree with you. But I don't have any reason to believe it's less. I think I have reason to believe the Sutent, you know, more, because they came up, you know, shorter and had a chance to receive, you know, other line of therapies. But we have to look at this. But this is becoming more and more common to report on any study that has OS as a primary or secondary endpoint on subsequent line of therapies, the number of systemic agents. Good question.
Thanks, it's Michael Schmidt again. Just to follow up, you know, with now more data accumulating for Cabo in RCC in different lines of treatment, you know, just thinking about the mechanism, is there, you know, are there any new insights in terms of the mechanistic rationale that could be applied to the ongoing liver cancer study now that there's more data available?
The liver cancer?
Liver cancer? Yeah, well, I think what we've seen, obviously, is that with the administration of sorafenib in liver cancer, for liver cancer, we see upregulation of these escape pathways, much like what was seen in the renal cell cancer setting with upregulation of MET and AXL. And so there's obviously a biological rationale that cabozantinib could interrupt such an escape phenomenon. Okay, there are other questions? Not, we have a couple minutes if there are any questions online.
All right, this first one. Has a procedure been adopted for an independent review of radiology scans? I don't know who you want to direct that to.
Yeah, as I mentioned earlier, the first step towards an independent radiology review is a collection of scans, and we're working with the Alliance to do that. And the procedure for an independent radiology review is a very well-established procedure that we've pursued at Exelixis with Meteor, and we're intending to apply the same, and that is really a central review, stringent review, blinded review of all the data and scans that will then be compiled in conjunction with the clinical database.
So we covered a lot of ground already. Yeah. Okay, yeah, sorry. Most of these we already covered. So, we want to thank everyone for coming out tonight, especially our panel, Dr. Schwery, Dr. Paul, and Dr. Tanier, and certainly our partner at Ipsen for co-hosting this great event with us. So thank you, and have a great evening.
Thank you.